guys, good morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and welcome back to Teachable Psych. My name is Sarah Jang, your host, and this month's episode features guest Dr. Kit Double, who currently teaches at the University of Sydney School of Psychology. Now, his research focuses primarily on how people monitor and control their thoughts and emotions. In this episode, we talk about how self-assessment can affect you and apply in the school setting. Now, I hope you guys enjoy this episode, and I'll see you at the end.
My name is Kit Dunn. I am a Australian Research Council research fellow at the University of Sydney in the School of Psychology. My research is in educational psychology, mainly looking at the field of metacognition.
What motivated you to study what you specifically do, and can you explain what it is?
Yeah, so I was interested in kind of self-awareness and consciousness, and I started looking at this kind of, I kind of fell into this to some degree when I started my PhD. So I became interested in whether we could use self-assessment as a tool to kind of improve performance. We kind of had some preliminary evidence in the lab that maybe it was good. And so when I was kind of choosing a PhD topic, I decided to pursue that and started looking at when self-assessment is good and when it's less good, these kinds of questions.
Okay. And what is a paradigm?
What is a paradigm?
Yes.
Paradigm is a way of doing things. So for example, you might have something like an experimental paradigm, which is, a kind of set of processes or procedures that you might use to study something or view something through a particular lens. You might have a paradigm that you use to typically in the lab, right? So, there might be some kind of experimental design that you use over and over again, and that becomes kind of a paradigm that you utilize.
This question's really broad, so you can take it however you like. How do you think education and psychology are correlated and or connected?
Yeah, so, I mean, the education's an interesting field. I've worked in both an education department and a psychology department over the course of my career. And education and psychology are quite different views of the world. Psychology very much kind of, if you look far enough back, it kind of is that Freud kind of stuff and kind of much more kind of speculative, interpreting your dreams and such. And then kind of over the decades becomes kind of very rooted in kind of the scientific method and trying to measure behavior, measure thoughts. And, it is really that scientific design, right? So you come up with a hypothesis, you generate an experiment, and you test that hypothesis. Education, because it's driven by an interest in the outcomes, how do we improve education? How do we talk about, broad things like educational quality and things that you can't really test with a lab experiment. It's much broader in terms of it brings together psychologists, it brings together sociologists, anthropologists. So it has a lot more different lenses and can be a lot broader, that kind of research. And so psychology, can be applied to education. It's one element that can be applied, one view that can, I think, improve education. But education, I would say, is more of a discipline that brings together researchers who have a whole heap of different ways of operating.
How do you think the psychology field has changed since you have entered it?
So I guess over the time I've been in psychology, one of the things, broadly as a field that's been happening is kind of grappling with the idea of replication, kind of 10 years ago or so, there's a big movement of like, how much of this stuff that we find can we actually replicate, right? How much is this real and robust kind of science? And I think we were probably a little worried about the results there and that maybe some of this stuff wasn't as reliable as we'd hoped. And so there's been a real push over, I think, the last decade to really improve our research practices, make our, you know, our data more open, really replicate our own experiments again and again, so we know that they're not a fluke, these kinds of things. And so that's one of the ways, you know, I think psychology has been kind of trying to improve itself as a science.
Can you talk about your most recent study?
Sure. So my most recent study is a set of experiments that look at self-assessment. And, you know, so we've done previous work where we looked at, you know, does self-assessment help your memory, right? If you're assessing yourself when you're trying to memorize, say, a list of word pairs or a list of words, can we actually, by getting you to self-assess? So that self-assessment might look like something like, so after I tell you to memorize a list of words, so dog, cat, monkey, blah, 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 I then ask you, you know, how likely is it that you'll remember these words, right? So you're self-assessing yourself as you go. And so we previously showed that that actually improves your memory, that kind of self-assessment. But what this experiment did was it actually changed some of the context when you were memorizing. So we actually changed the font size of the words. Some of those words were in really big font, and some of them were in really small font. And what we know previously is that people think words in really big font are much more memorable. But in reality, there's very little effect of how big the font is. And so we kind of got you self-assessed, but in this context where you're falling for this illusion, right? This illusion that font size matters. And we actually showed in that context, self-assessment can be bad, right? Because when you're self-assessing, you're paying attention to the font size. And the font size isn't a particularly useful thing for you to think about when it comes to doing the test at the end.
Interesting. So are the results just that the font size didn't matter or impact anything?
Yeah, the font size didn't have any impact, but you know, I guess crucially, the group that did the self-assessment actually performed worse than the group that didn't. So it's, I guess, an interaction there where, like, if we make the font size inconsistent, then this self-assessment process, which we know from other contexts is beneficial, actually hurts your performance, actually makes it worse. So, you know, that self-assessment, when it's based on something inaccurate, when it's based on an illusion, can actually be a negative rather than a positive.
Okay. Have you guys studied, like, because a lot of people say, like, highlighting your text when you're reading, it helps you memorize better. Have you guys researched that yet?
Yeah, people have done things along those. Yeah, certainly, you know, things like highlighting, using different fonts can help you memorize. The biggest thing we know that will help you learn and memorize probably is testing yourself. So rather than reading your textbook again, you know, creating some flashcards and some practice questions and just testing yourself is way better for your memory than reading something. So, you know, if I ask you what the capital of Turkey is and you take a guess, and then I tell you the capital of Turkey is Istanbul, you're much more likely to remember that than if I just tell you that the capital of Turkey is Istanbul.
Okay. So in your study, the impact of peer assessment on academic performance, how exactly does it improve academic performance? Is it because students are more aware of the details and then it improves their own work?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So that study, I guess, summarized or aggregated across a lot of other people's studies. So basically looked across, like, everything we know about peer assessment, does it seem to work? And so that study found that, you know, students who do peer assessment outperform, say, people who are just receiving teacher assessment. Why that is very unclear, right? Is it because being a peer, when you're doing peer assessment, you're receiving feedback from your peers? Presumably that feedback, you know, with no disrespect to your peers, probably isn't as good as the teacher feedback. But the one thing you get to do in peer assessment that you don't get to do in teacher assessment is you actually get to act as the assessor. You get to read your peers' work. You get to evaluate your peers' work. And that also makes you think critically about, like, is this good? Is this bad? Are they answering the question? Could they have done this better? And I think it's that act of being the assessor that's actually really useful. I suspect. It's hard to tell because not enough experiments really differentiate between being assessed in a peer assessment context or being the assessor. In most experiments, you do both those things. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to tell which one's important. But I suspect it's actually being the assessor that's actually really important.
So if you were to do a follow-up study, would you separate the groups? So have one only be the assessor and one only be the receiver?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I was to run a study, I would compare a group who did both and a group who did who was the assessor and a group who was the kind of assessee. And compare that to, say, something like teacher assessment.
How did you and the other researchers come up with this topic? Or what motivated you?
Of peer assessment?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so peer assessment has kind of become popular in education research as part of this movement towards what's called formative assessment. So formative assessment is this idea that rather than just at the end of the year, we give you this test. And you get a score on the test, and then you move on to the next year at school, say. Right? That's what we would call summative assessment, right? So you know, it's a summation of your year. This idea kind of came out a few decades ago that we can actually use assessment as a tool to help students learn about what they do and don't know. And so this kind of reshaping of this idea of assessment is not this just thing we use to evaluate students at the end, but this tool that we can actually use to improve grades. And so that really focused in on self-assessment and peer assessment, as well as using teacher assessment in kind of a new way where it was actually used to give you feedback kind of in at an intermediate step so you can actually take that, what you're being told, and improve upon it. And so peer assessment kind of has kind of shot up in interest for that reason. I mean, the other benefit of peer assessment, of course, from an educational point of view, is it doesn't require the same resources, right? There's only one teacher, there's 30 students. That's a lot of marking, right? So peer assessment can actually be like a really efficient way of providing potentially really good, yeah, as that study would suggest, really useful feedback to students.
Could another idea be for a follow-up to be to do peer assessments across grades and see if that makes a difference? Like if they're in sixth grade and they have like eighth grade or even high schoolers who look at their project or paper?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely, it'd be an interesting topic to see how kind of expertise, grade difference is one way of conceptualizing that expertise actually matters, right? You know, if I'm providing you feedback and I know a lot more than you, I can presumably provide you with better feedback, right? Mm-hmm. But there's probably less benefit to me, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm not learning from what I'm reading, I'm not learning from you. So I'd be really curious to see, if it's better to actually do this as peers, right? People from the same grade, or whether it's beneficial to actually, go above or below that in terms of grades.
For your next study, the casual illusions in the classroom, how the distribution of student outcomes can promote false instructional benefits. What is the difference between novel and ordinary instruction?
Yeah, so that was a study where we were looking at how teachers evaluate how effective they are, right? And it was based on this idea that to do that, teachers have to monitor the outcomes of what they're doing, right? Like if they start teaching in a particular way, they have to say, well, the grade, for Sarah's grade was 80. And then they had to, if they try some other teaching method, they may, well, Sarah's grade was 70. And they try some other teaching method, and like Sarah's grade was 85. And then they have to try and work out, by comparing you and all the other students, which way is actually the most effective way to teach. And so we were interested in how they form those judgments. And so in that study, teaching as usual, ordinary teaching, and this new kind of teaching method was completely made up. We just told the teachers or the participants in the study, this is the teaching method that we use today. This is the teaching method we use today. And it was completely made up and arbitrary. but we were really interested in how they monitored the outcomes of those teaching strategies. And so we manipulated the feedback of like, how effective was this new teaching style? And then at the end of the experiment, we said, so how effective do you think this new teaching style was compared to ordinary teaching? So they've seen a series of trials where they were told, we used newfangled teaching method and the average mark for the class was 80. We used the ordinary teaching method and the mark for the class was 70. We used blah, 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 blah. And so we actually know the contingency. We know the difference between the new teaching style and the ordinary teaching style. But we asked the teachers or the participants of the study, what do you think was the difference? And a lot of the time, the difference was zero. So the new teaching style didn't do anything. It wasn't effective. But if the students were doing well, teachers thought they were helping, right? And so there's this kind of bias where, you know, if you're in a class where everyone's doing well, right, everyone's getting 80s or the average of the class is really high, you actually think that the things you're doing are causing that, right? You're thinking it's because you're doing these amazing teaching techniques. But a lot of the times it's actually just that they're amazing students, right? So it's very hard for a teacher to really separate out their contribution and the student's contribution in a context where you have an amazing group of students. Or you could be a bit cynical and say, well, if we set the marks in exams so that everyone gets 80, right? If the average mark in an exam is set as 80, teachers find it really hard to know if what they're doing is effective because everyone's doing really well because you kind of arbitrarily made the exams really easy.
So is there then like a certain teaching style that a teacher can't implement where they do improve the students rather than it's just the students themselves, not the teacher?
Yeah, there's of course, you know, a whole area looking at, you know, instructional approaches and what's a better instructional approach. So it's not to say that there aren't more effective ways of teaching than others. There of course are much better ways of teaching than others. But this was, I guess, this was more interested at how do people judge that? You know, if you're a teacher, how do you actually really evaluate yourself, right? It's that same kind of self-assessment, but now it's self-assessment for teachers. How do they assess themselves? But yeah, in terms of instructional approaches, so we know things like direct instruction, so, you know, giving people worked examples, these kinds of things are really useful. Like, we want to kind of reduce the load on students. We don't want them overwhelmed, so we try and particularly reduce the kind of load that isn't related to the problem, right? So no extra things to think about and help people focus, providing direct examples, these kinds of things. So, you know, certainly, you know, if you go to university to become a teacher, you spend a lot of that time learning about how to provide good instruction to students.
So if you were to implement this self-assessment for teachers across schools, how would it be formulated? Would it be like, would it have to have a research team every single time to do a whole project on them, or would it be like a test?
Yeah, so I mean, I think my work on self-assessment is maybe a little pessimistic about the potential benefits of self-assessment. So, you know, one of the things I've found again and again is that self-assessment is really good if you have a high opinion of yourself, right? If you're a confident person, self-assessment is really good. But if you're not a confident person, self-assessment can actually be bad. So assessing yourself if you don't think you're doing very well can actually make you perform worse. And so I'm reluctant to say go into a classroom and apply self-assessment just as a, you know, general thing, like let's everyone do a self-assessment, right? I think there are times when self-assessment is going to work. There are students who self-assessment is going to work on, but there are also students who maybe won't benefit. And so I think one of the goals of my kind of work at the moment is trying to really understand when should we do self-assessment? How should we do self-assessment? You know, how do we word our self-assessment? How do we actually structure the self-assessment in terms of making it beneficial instead of just going in and saying, right, we're going to self-assess today, and seeing how that goes.
How do you think education as a whole, or if there's a specific detail, has changed since COVID-19?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's changed in so many ways, I guess, over the time. I mean, I'm not a practicing teacher. I don't go into kind of high school classes or anything. But, you know, from my point of view as a university professor, you know, we've obviously moved things online and then we've shifted back to offline. And while, you know, from a certain point of view, what we're doing is really business as usual. We're back in the class. We're doing, in many ways, what we were doing before. I think students haven't necessarily made that same shift, right? Attendance is down. The expectations have changed from students. You know, how they consume knowledge has changed. They want, you know, recordings and they want the option of hybrid. You know, they want to be able to do things online when they want them to come in. And so I think we've really had to shift and focus in on engagement and classroom engagement and trying to make sure that, you know, university is a bit different, right? It's largely optional whether you turn up. And so partly it's shifted in terms of us trying to show the value to the students and make sure they are getting value from turning up to class.
Okay, so and most of your studies, it could be probably applied to most age groups. Is there a specific section of grade that you focus on?
So most of my studies are on kind of undergraduate university students. So I typically run experiments with my own students and students that are kind of around the campus. And, you know, the entire fields of psychology dedicated to try and understand that kind of development and how people change over time, particularly in those kind of early ages where we do see that. You know, things like self-assessment are really interesting in those age groups as well, because young kids aren't very good at it. Young kids don't necessarily monitor how they're doing particularly well. They don't pay attention to that particularly well. And so that has some interesting implications for learning and these kinds of things. So while I'm really interested in younger groups, most of my work, partly just due to convenience, because that those are the people who are wandering past my lab and I can make do an experiment or invite to do an experiment. So most of it's been on kind of undergraduate level.
So have you ever been able to work with other professors or professionals abroad, or have been able to research how education is different in other countries?
Yeah, so one of the kind of I've worked in the UK as well, and so when I was working over there at the University of Oxford, we actually collaborated with the International Baccalaureate Organization. So that is a international organization that kind of offer a high school qualification that you can use to get into university internationally. And so it's offered in many, many, many countries. And so one of the projects we worked with them was to go into schools in the UK, in Norway, in Australia, and actually compare students who are doing this degree with students who are doing the kind of national programs in each of those countries. And we were particularly interested in their critical thinking skills. So the idea of this IB program, or the International Baccalaureate, is, you know, they teach critical thinking in quite a unique way, in that they have a whole course dedicated to critical thinking. They actually write a thesis as part of their kind of year, their kind of final year in high school. And so what we're interested in is, all right, well, do these students actually have higher critical thinking? So we went to these different countries, which is really interesting, you know, because it allows us to see compared to different national programs, as well as to see how this is implemented in different countries. And look at their critical thinking.
So for the IB program, do they follow the same like criteria and expectations?
The IB program is consistent across the world. So, you know, the kind of expectations and the, you know, syllabus and that kind of thing is the same no matter what country you do it in, basically. Whereas the national programs obviously differ quite substantially. You know, your ordinary school in Australia, high school in Australia that's not doing the IB is quite different to your ordinary school in the UK who's not doing the IB, but the IB program itself is pretty much the same in all those countries.
Mm-hmm. So in your project or the research that you did on the IB program, what were the results?
So we actually found that students who are enrolled in the IB program have higher critical thinking, which might be because the IB program is good at promoting the development of critical thinking. It might be that this kind of instructional approach is beneficial. It also might be that students who are really good critical thinkers want to enroll in the IB, right? So, if you're kind of halfway through your high school and you're thinking, should I enroll in the IB or in the national program, and you're the kind of person who likes critical thinking, who likes thinking about abstract ideas, you might think, oh, I want to do the IB because it has a thesis and I get to, try some of these ideas out. So it's hard to know the causation, right? Is it the IB improving critical thinking, or is it people who are good at critical thinking selecting into the IB? We did find a benefit, or we did find higher critical thinking in the IB.
Could it also be the students that are enrolled in the program have more access to resources and the ability to participate in these kind of activities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to do that in kind of a multinational way is the way the IB is applied in different countries differs. So, for example, in Australia, the IB program is offered at, tends to be offered at very elite private schools with huge amounts of resources. But in Norway, it's offered pretty much everywhere. It's just kind of a normal thing. So, this is always a problem when you're doing research, is the schools that sign up for research are the ones with more resources generally, because they have the time and so forth. It's certainly a concern that the students with more resources or the schools with more resources offer the IB program, and that's what's actually driving this effect as well.
Hi guys, and welcome back. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did and learned new information on how your self-assessment affects you. Now I hope you have a good rest of your morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and I'll see you next time.